Hello, welcome to the Investment Trust Insider podcast. My name is Gavin Lumsden, and today we're having a close look at private equity, how to invest in private, unquoted companies through an investment trust listed on the London Stock Exchange. And with me is Helen Steers, a partner at Pantheon Ventures, who at the start of the year took over as the lead manager from Andrew Liebus of Pantheon International, which is one of around 14 or 15 private equity trusts listed in London. Helen, welcome. Very nice to see you.
Good afternoon, Gavin. I'm delighted to be here and thank you for inviting me.
Fantastic. Now, I've mentioned that you've just recently taken over responsibility for Pantheon International, but actually you've been around at Pantheon for quite a long time and involved in the investment trust for at least 5 years. Is that right?
Yes, I took over from Andrew Liebus, who's a veteran and has been managing the trust for a very long period of time. I took over a couple of months ago, but actually I've been involved in working with Andrew on the trust for the last 5 years, since 2015, and I've been a partner at Pantheon actually for 15 years.
Okay, and now that's great. Now, there are two types of private equity investment trust, aren't there? Those that invest directly into private companies and those that invest through fund managers, other fund managers. You take that latter fund of funds approach, isn't that right?
Well, it's actually a mixed approach. We do have part of the portfolio which is invested in funds, so we're fund of funds for part of the portfolio, but we also increasingly invest directly into companies alongside our fund managers, and those are called co-investments. So we co-invest with some of our leading private equity managers across the world. They sometimes have opportunities where they need a little bit more equity capital, and because we've been partnering with them for such a long time on the fund side, they approach us with those sorts of opportunities. So the portfolio is now pretty much one third into primaries, into co-investments, and then of course secondaries, where we buy stakes in private equity funds from other investors, actually, I should say.
Yes, people will be interested to know that. So there's a secondary market in sort of secondhand stakes in these private equity funds. These are very exclusive private equity funds that only people like yourselves can access. Ordinary mortals can only invest in your shares rather than some of these specialist limited partnerships.
Well, that's one of the reasons why PIP exists, actually, is to give the person on the street the opportunity to buy private equity, because you're absolutely right. Some of these top private equity funds are extremely difficult to access. They have minimum entry levels, which can often be tens of millions of dollars or euros or pounds, plus sometimes they're just very exclusive and they will pick and choose their investors. So by buying a share of PIP, you get access to all of that without having to have sort of tens of millions of pounds in your pocket.
And how many of these fund managers are you working with, are investing through?
So we invest with a whole array of different managers right across the world. We invest in US, Europe and Asia. We invest in venture, buyout, growth capital. But if you look at where the bulk of the portfolio is, so about 80% of the value is concentrated in about 70 managers.
Okay. And can they invest in the same companies? Can you end up having bigger exposure to the underlying companies because there's one or more managers actually like the same company?
So occasionally they will, but it's not a very frequent occurrence these days. I think wind the clock back sort of 15, 20 years, and there was a lot more of this sort of co-investing going on between different managers. Nowadays, the managers tend to like to keep those opportunities for themselves. And if they have the need for more capital, they'll come to somebody like PIP and offer us this sort of equity co-investment. So actually that's really driving some of this opportunity in co-investment. It's the fact that these private equity managers are doing less of what we call club deals, and they're offering these opportunities to their investors like ourselves.
Now, you've produced a report showing or making the case for how private equity, exposure to private equity to unlisted companies can really benefit investors' portfolios. And we'll probably come back to that. But I'd also wonder if we could focus much more on recent events. And obviously, everybody's struggling with the impact of coronavirus on the economy. It's a health crisis, it's a financial crisis. One of the drawbacks of private equity, it seems, is there is quite a time lag, at least 3 months, in terms of the news and the results and the valuations coming through from the fund managers you invest in. I guess there isn't much of a way around that. But is that shares in the sector have been hit quite hard, like other funds? But is that 25% discount, for example, on your shares, they're trading 25% below their net asset value, like many of their rivals. Is that telling you that investors are expecting more bad news to be coming through?
So it's a great question. I think that actually, I mean, our discount is not justified. We believe there's a huge amount of value in the portfolio, and therefore applying, you know, 25% discount to the NAV seems somewhat draconian. I think there's a number of different reasons for the discount, and if you look back, you know, over the past little while, there has been a bit of a stubborn discount in the sector in general, and I think that's due to a number of different reasons. It's partly this issue of trying to get the information. We have the information clearly, but then sort of transmitting that to investors, and a little bit of lack of sort of knowledge, I think, about the sector as well. So we're trying to do our best to be as transparent, to give as much information as possible, so that people can develop more confidence, I think, in the private equity sector.
Yeah, okay. And in March, you took the, I've mentioned the fact that there's a time lag, but you are doing your best, it seems, to try and reflect the underlying reality. The problem you've got and all your rivals is that, you know, they're producing annual results to the end of last year or end of January, end of February, and they all look amazing. But of course, then they get, you know, everybody knows things then tanked quite badly because of the epidemic, and they want to get a handle on what's going on. And in March, you actually tried to do that. You took a manager's provision of £122 million, which is equivalent to nearly 8% of the trust net assets. Mm-hmm. I'd still just explain to me, that's quite an unusual step, isn't it, in the sector? What exactly was that provision?
Yeah, no, you're right, but you know, unusual step, but actually an unusual set of circumstances. So what happened was, you know, as you're aware, I mean, our valuations are based on in the most recent information we have coming through from the private equity managers who manage the underlying companies. And as you're aware as well, there's this time lag. So if we'd waited until we'd got all the Q1 valuations in, which are now really just sort of starting to flood in at the moment, you know, we felt that given all the circumstances in the market, that might not be giving as much information as we possibly could to our investors. So what we did was, given the fact that, in fact, the information we had at Q1 was about 94% off December valuations, but in the meantime, we'd seen this big, you know, as you've mentioned, this big fall off in public markets at the end of March, we felt what we should do is really do the sort of rather intense exercise of a flash valuation. So we went back to all of our underlying managers, we had conversations with them, and we asked for guidance. We asked for guidance as to where they thought they would be at the end of Q1. And in fact, we were very successful in getting, you know, pretty good coverage from the managers. I believe in the end, we got guidance from managers that represented about 71% of PIP's portfolio. And then there was a small amount of the portfolio that's in publicly quoted stocks, so companies that already IPO'd. Of course, we could write those to the most recent mark. And then with the remaining part of the portfolio, we used quite an interesting sort of algorithm that we got at Pantheon to look at public market changes in the various different sectors, and then apply a sort of a private market adjustment to that, so that overall we could come up with this manager's provision, which we felt would better reflect the circumstances at the end of March. So it was a very intense exercise. It involved a lot of direct conversations with the managers. But we're able to do that because of the fact that we've got these close relationships. We're a direct holder into the funds, and then sometimes indirectly into the companies too. There's no intermediary vehicle there. So we're not a funder funds. So we were able to get this information directly from the managers.
It's impressive that you managed to get people to the fund managers to respond in that way, because investors needed the information. But what do you think, are analysts right to think that there's a kind of two-stage adjustment in private equity valuations mm-hmm. going on? Because, you know, the shares, you lowered the NAV, effectively, the net asset value, but the mm-hmm. shares are still trading well below that. And analysts are saying that's because they're expecting this two-stage. We've had the... there's two stages to a valuation decline in private equity. One is the lowering the multiples, the valuation multiples that are applied to companies, and that's broadly just taken across from public stock markets. So you're reflecting the stock market crash. But then later in the year, we'll actually get proper results from the underlying companies, and we'll see that, you know, earnings and profits may well be falling a lot. And so are investors still anticipating that second wave of negative news before they really have confidence in the shares?
So it's another great question. I think what it's reflecting is really the uncertainty, because nobody knows exactly where Q2 is going to come out, and actually nobody really knows where Q3, if we go forward a little bit, is going to come out either. So I think it's reflecting the uncertainty. I also think that there's going to be a huge difference in terms of the impact on different sectors, maybe different geographies as well. So the market is maybe trying to anticipate that, but I think it's a really hard thing to try and do. You know, and we don't even know whether there's going to be a second wave of infections, you know, what sort of recovery we're going to have. I think it's already clear which sectors are doing better than others. And that's something that actually is giving us a little bit of cause for cheer, I think, in our portfolio, because as you're aware, our portfolio is very much weighted towards the more resilient sectors.
We know that travel and hospitality sectors have been hit very hard. Are you saying that you've got no involvement in those sectors? What areas are you represented in?
So our major sectors are information technology, healthcare, financials, and then we do have a certain amount of consumer staples. So, for example, we've got a company in the portfolio which makes toilet paper, which is obviously has been hit in a positive way. We've got food staples. We've got groceries. We have a small amount of consumer discretionary, which has been harder hit, but a very, very small exposure to the travel and hospitality sector. This was a sector that might have been in vogue, you know, a few years ago in private equity. But there's been quite a big shift to sort of newer technologies. And actually, if you look through our portfolio at the moment, probably around 43-44% is in information technology and in healthcare. So right. And then if you add in things like fintech and then consumer staples, well over 50-60% of the portfolio, I would say, is in these more resilient sectors.
And what are the fund managers telling you that you're investing in? Are they you know, what kind of range of experience are their companies facing?
So the response from the managers has been great, actually, and we've had huge amounts of information through from them, which always sort of makes me laugh a little bit when people talk about the intransparency of private equity, because we're able to get a great deal of information at the underlying portfolio company level. So they've really been focusing on, I would say, sort of three main things. So to start with, clearly the focus was very much on sort of health and safety in the portfolio companies. That was the first thing, you know, making, you know, being responsible owners of the business. Second, it was really on operations. So looking at the supply chain impact, which is really what hit us first because of supply chains coming out of the Far East, and then the demand impact really on the portfolio companies. And then after that, the focus really switched to liquidity and cash management. I think it's one of the beauties of private equity, actually, that these managers are extremely nimble, they're very flexible, and they've got a huge amount of expertise that they can then apply to the portfolio companies, operational expertise. So they've really... they put SWAT teams all over these portfolio companies. So whether it's giving them experts in procurement, supply chain management, accelerating digital marketing, you know, and everybody's had to accelerate the online experience, but the portfolio companies have really been on this fast track. And then their capital markets expertise has been essential in helping the companies get through, you know, what could have been difficult sort of liquidity periods over the last few weeks.
Yeah, I was surprised reading through your recent newsletters, monthly reports, that you've continued to make new investments since March. other funds in other areas have, you know, have ceased that kind of activity as they take stock on what's going on. What kind of investments have you been making?
So we're actually encouraged. There's still investment activity going on. I think particularly in the sectors that I mentioned, in the more resilient sectors, information technology and healthcare. Just to give you a couple of examples, we made a commitment to one of the top venture managers in the world in March. So in the midst of the crisis, and that's Index Ventures Growth. And they invest in information technology, things like enterprise software, SaaS. So all of this is stuff that is, you know, very much in demand at the moment. We also made a co-investment in a company which is in the cybersecurity area. And as you're aware, that's been another sector that's highly in demand. So there have been, I mean, I hesitate to say there have been winners out of this, because I think, you know, with a global pandemic, there really aren't any winners. But there are certainly some portfolio companies that are able to, you know, take advantage of certain circumstances and trends.
You're well positioned in some growth areas, but obviously these are very uncertain times. And analysts, again, have been more positive on the sector, saying that trusts like yourselves have learned the lessons of the last financial crisis, when, you know, some funds went into that downturn with you know, weak balance sheets, and they had overcommitted themselves to invest money that subsequently they realised they didn't have. This time around, the sector seems to be in a much better shape. You've recently increased your credit facility, so could you just talk us through what, you know, what is the state of your balance sheet? How much money you've got at your disposal versus the commitments, the investment commitments that you have to make in the future?
So we believe we're actually in a very strong position from a financial standpoint. So we've got a banking facility which is fully unutilized, so £300 million denominated in the currencies of the underlying commitments, so US, mostly US dollars and euros. So we've got a huge uncalled banking facility, and on top of that we've got cash on the balance sheet, and we think that puts us in a very good position indeed in terms of our coverage, and in terms of lessons learned since the financial crisis. I mean, certainly at the PIP level, but also at the underlying fund manager level, I think that, you know, after 10 years of expansion, the GPs, the fund managers, were sort of expecting a downturn. They maybe weren't expecting this downturn and not this sort of a trigger, but they'd certainly been preparing their portfolio companies. So even at the underlying portfolio level, you know, they'd been managing the balance sheets, they'd been pushing out maturities. So I actually think the whole sector is in a better position than it was in the GFC.
Okay, thanks for that. Let's turn to this report that you've done, Mind the Allocation Gap report, because you're highlighting that while some institutional investors like pension funds have really increased quite dramatically the amount they're investing in private equity, the same has not been the case for private investors, retail investors, and their advisors, who've stayed underweight the sector. What I'm going to give you an easy one here, but what are the advantages then? What was your study looking to do, and what did it show?
So the idea of the study was really to take a portfolio without an alternative investment portfolio without private equity, and compare that with an alternative investment portfolio with private equity, and to see, you know, what the benefits were. And we used PIP as the proxy, because, you know, it's been a very long established vehicle out there. You know, there's a lot of data there for the researchers to work with. And when they combined PIP in the portfolio, they noticed that actually the results were better. So we believe that having an investment trust like PIP, which, you know, basically offers liquid access to an illiquid asset class, and some diversification benefits, as well as the greater returns which are available in private equity, you know, we think that's a win-win for investors.
Yeah, now, of course, you would say that, the private equity being what you do, but that we have seen, even in the kind of retail investment sector, we have seen funds like Scottish Mortgage investing more and more in unlisted companies, And the likes of Merry and Chrysalis has been quite a successful launch in the past year or two. So, and existing other funds like Caledonia are well known for having a large allocations to private equity. And then, of course, there is your own self and your direct peers in the private equity sector. But of course, it's all very well for pointing to the theory, but execution is key, isn't it? We famously saw with Neil Woodford last year just how bad dabbling around in illiquid and unquoted stocks can get you. And has that left a suspicion in investors' minds over private equity, do you think?
So as I said at the beginning, I think it's a little bit of a misunderstood asset class. And I think the fact that, you know, the person on the street finds it difficult to access, you know, these high minimum investment thresholds, you know, there's, if you invest in a private equity fund, there's this sort of lack of liquidity. People find it complex to understand. But in fact, if you cut through it all, what are we doing? We're investing in companies. They just happen to be privately owned rather than publicly owned. But these privately owned companies are investing in some high growth areas of the market. They're investing in certain sectors which are really underrepresented, I think, as well on public markets. If you look at our results over the last few years, you'll see that the companies have grown both revenue and earnings faster than public markets and the equivalents of the public markets. So I think that there's a bit of a misunderstanding here, and maybe we've got more of a sort of a communications challenge on our hands to really talk a little bit more about what we're really investing in. And it's not really such a mystery. So I think it's being a little bit more clear, a bit more transparent, giving people more guidance about what they're actually getting in a private equity portfolio.
I guess part of the problem is there is this kind of overall complexity. You're investing in fund managers that we don't really know about, and then they're investing in companies. But it is reassuring to hear you talk about some of these companies and the sectors they're in. They do sound quite similar to the quoted companies that conventional investment funds are investing in. So that all sounds... And your annual report does go into details of some of these companies, so the information is there. But I think, nevertheless, it's that sort of double layer, which brings me on to another point. What about charges? And private equity does have a reputation of being expensive. Now, your ongoing charges, I think, are around about 1.2%, which actually is kind of pretty reasonable, given it's a sort of specialist activity. But they probably don't include these carry fees that are prevalent in private equity, which is when you sell a company, the fund manager will take a cut, a share of the profit in that sale. Those tend not to be reflected in the ongoing charges. Am I right? And I think that adds to a sense of investor unease about what's going on underneath the surface.
Well, we do publish our entire sort of expense ratio there. So if you look at the key information document, the KID, that actually does give sort of the look through all the way through. And it does reflect both the management fees and the carried interest, which is the performance fee, which is taken by the managers. But I just would like to make one thing clear. People talk a lot about carried interest, and it's a performance fee. But it's a performance fee which is only paid if the manager overall makes a return on the fund, which is over a certain hurdle rate. And those hurdle rates are usually between sort of 8 and sometimes up to 10%, actually. So it's not a performance fee which is paid on an annual basis at a high watermark. It's usually paid, a long way into the life of a private equity fund when the investments have been sold, the profits have been made, and therefore you can see the overall results of the fund. So it's something which is really paid for performance. It's not paid going along. It's not part of the management fee.
So it's all in the asset value and the total shareholder returns that people can see. Thanks for that clarification, Helen. I just wanted to finish off and sort of have a quick look at some performance figures I've got here on Pantheon. I'm asking you really, what message you think investors could draw from these. These are figures taken from Numis Securities based on Morningstar figures, just so we're clear. But it shows that up to last week, over 10 years, Pantheon had delivered a total growth in the portfolio of 193%, which was actually broadly in line with the MSCI World Index, like global stock markets, And there's a private equity index you misreferred to called LPX Europe. Is that does that mean something to you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that really mixes in a lot of different vehicles. So it's both the direct vehicles, fund-to-fund vehicles, vehicles like ourselves, which invest both in sort of co-investments and funds. So it's a bit of a hybrid, I would say. I mean, I think it's probably more interesting for investors to look over the, you know, over the long term, look over different periods as well, and see how we've outperformed. And if you look at the latest, look at the 31st of March newsletter, you'll see that since inception, you know, we've outperformed both the FTSE and the MSCI world by really quite large margins. So since inception, it's about 11.5% in terms of NAV. And even over a 10-year period, you know, we've outperformed. But I think you have to look over different time periods. And private equity is for the long term.
No, absolutely. No, I was going to say, and the trust was launched in 1987. So those figures you're talking about go back to there. And that's a really long period and an impressive growth. And even the 10-year figures I was referring to, I was quoting that the FTSE All Share has done far, far less. So it's beaten the UK stock market. And the figures I was using were the net asset values. That's the underlying growth in the underlying portfolio. What I wanted to come on to then is that the share price, the shareholder return, according to these new Miss and Morningstar figures, was 309%. So that's 309% versus the 193% in the asset value. Mm. And that's because 10 years ago, we were coming out of the previous financial crisis, and the shares were trading on very wide discount back then, and there's been a big re-rating, notwithstanding the fact that they're on this 25% discount today. So 309% shareholder return is definitely very impressive. And I'm just wondering, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty, and I'm not trying to get you to pump your own shares, and I'm not recommending that anybody get them. But it's an interesting, I'm just wondering, are we beginning to approach a similar point in history with the wide discount on trusts like Pantheon? Because it would seem that over 10 years, the fund managers that you invest in have delivered good returns from the private equity asset class. But if you get a timing right, it seems that you can get much bigger returns.
Well, we would never obviously advocate sort of timing the market or anything like that. We believe in sort of steady deployment. But it is true, if you look at the last financial crisis and look at how private equity performed coming out of the crisis, it actually performed better than public markets. And I think part of the reasons for that is really the fundamental advantages of private equity. You know, it's really super active equity. You've got these fund managers that are thoroughly hands-on with the underlying portfolio companies, which usually they control. They've usually got controlling stakes. They're very well aligned. You know, I mentioned carried interest earlier. You know, they only ever get these big payoffs if they add a huge amount of value to the portfolio companies. So we think that between, you know, the great alignment of interest, this really sort of hands-on operating expertise, and the fact that the fund managers are concentrating on these higher growth sectors, which should do well actually coming out of this current environment, we think it's a very attractive asset class to be thinking about. And PIP is a great way to get access to it because it's so difficult to do it through the conventional means that the big institutional investors use, you know, the big, you know, the Yale and the other big university endowment funds. So this is a way for the person on the street really to participate in an exciting and growing asset class.
Okay, Helen, well, we'll leave it there. Thanks very much for joining me today and for explaining what it is Pantheon and private equity managers do. Thank you.
Gavin, thank you very much indeed. Pleasure to speak to you.